Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the New Book Network podcast. I'm Deidre Tyler. Today, we'll be talking with Talani Davis, author of The Emancipation Circuit, Black Activists Forging a Culture of Freedom. Professor Davis is also a professor of the Nellie Y. McKay Fellow in the African American Studies Department at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. How are you doing today, Professor?
I'm great, thank you.
Can you tell us a little about yourself and how you became interested in this project?
Well, I grew up in the South. I've been interested in what happened when freedom came probably most of my life. I grew up in a town where most of the children I went to school with were descendants of contrabands. Those were fugitives from slavery who took shelter in a local fort. My book begins in that fort, basically, because the story begins there. I did not know that when I was a child, but it is something that we all took for granted, that the Black kids, I went to segregated schools, I should say. All these young people I'm referring to are Black people from Hampton, Virginia. We all knew we had built our neighborhood, so to speak. That had happened after slavery, but the textbooks in Virginia are like the textbooks today, except my textbooks made a lot of really negative remarks about Black people having never contributed anything to Southern culture except singing. The music they created while they were picking cotton, my textbooks said that picking cotton was what we did. Where I live, people in slavery fished. People picked tobacco, raised tobacco, picked tobacco, processed tobacco. There were many different kinds of slavery. And so we all knew that what we were learning is was skewed and incorrect. I don't know if students know that nowadays. My students know very little about slavery at all, less than I was taught. So in high school, I read Du Bois's Black Reconstruction, and I more or less thought he had said it all. So I would never have thought I would be writing any book going back and looking at that same period and the work he did. But it occurred to me because of my own experience that the books were dealing with what the white guys in Washington were doing during Reconstruction. Most of the histories deal with the political history. And it occurred to me that the Southern Black movement, one, was a movement, and two, that communities were connected. And this I knew from being someone who grew up in segregation, I knew that the previous generations probably were connected. And once I went looking for it, I discovered people getting on sailboats to go from Norfolk to Hampton to go to political meetings, people who had been out of slavery, 6 months, going to have meetings with hundreds of people, all of whom almost all of whom could not read. So they actually built this movement with a largely illiterate population, in which there were meetings where people sent representatives to memorize everything that was said in the meeting, that there were meetings of 3,000 fugitives from slavery at a time, in a field, in a southern town, with guns to protect themselves. It's these are stories I did not hear.
In your book, you talk about no food, housing, clothes, water, sewage, medical, education. How did the free Black people help build the community?
Well, the ports on the Atlantic coast were full of people from different plantations who didn't know each other. So they might have ended up in a port with a small free Black community. Usually the first way in which those people helped was to try to bring some first aid to the camps where Black people were camping out, and or food. And they frequently had a church, a local church, that would be the only church Black people could go to without being placed in the balcony as slaves of the slaveholders who went to a given church. So their communities generally were too small in order to be able to help all of the people who might have landed in their community. A town like my hometown, which had 2,500 people in it normally or less, suddenly had 10,000 people. So how many of the 2,500 would have been free Blacks? How much help could they have provided? Everybody pretty much organized themselves. So people who were camped outside of an army camp, they formed their own groups to do religious practice, for instance. This was something that seemed like a sudden opportunity from being a fugitive, as opposed to being on a plantation where you could not practice your religion freely or openly. So they started having gatherings, not just on Sunday, but several times a week. In those gatherings and in political meetings, those people gave testimony as to what their lives had been like. So what happens is that there are people from, let's say, five different plantations in a region, people who may have known one or two people from another farm, but who generally speaking didn't know each other. They form community because they're sleeping on the ground, perhaps in tents, but with no wooden floors. They are forming community with whoever's in the next tent. And in that sense, there's two things that happen. One, it's new community for everybody involved. And two, people who had been enslaved who come to a military outpost where there's 10,000 other Black people who've been enslaved see how large slavery was for the first time. They built in that moment and in talking to each other this thing called we, meaning the way we use it now. If I say, well, you know what we say, you know, I mean, we Black people or we people who are partaking of Black culture or whatever. But it used to be we, the people of a particular farm, a particular labor camp. It's like, well, we've been treated poorly. Then the we gets to be huge.
Now, you talk about the burial societies. I thought that was interesting, how they had to bury the dead. Tell us a story about that. Within your book, you said a lot of the people could not be buried on the plantation, so they had to structure their own associations or societies.
Well, if you worked on a plantation and said something smart to the master and he turned around and shot you, you got buried on his land. If you died of old age on his land, you got buried on his land. You may or may not have had a service that involved the people in the Black community who lived in the quarters paying respects. People who of mixed heritage who were free people or considered freed people they would have to buy land to bury people. They couldn't be in the local town cemetery because those cemeteries were whites only probably till 1970s. You just wouldn't be buried on sacred ground in those churches. So knowing it wouldn't be just their family, they combined their efforts. And so the oldest Black cemeteries in the South were generally formed by people who were free people in the community who had the need to have a Black resting place where their families could be buried with respect. So part of our history that, and they were doing this before the end of slavery. It's not a big part of my book and what I'm telling you about what people did after slavery. I mentioned them only to say that they were a model of the hundreds of societies that were formed in freedom. So those burial societies existed, but they were actually subsumed by societies that, men who got together to try to put together fire services for putting out fires. Local fire trucks, such as they were, would not go to a Black neighborhood if there was a Black neighborhood. And in freedom, Black neighborhoods are new. So the people who've been living in the town all this time are not sending a fire truck over to this new neighborhood where these free people are living. So it was in order to put out a fire in a Black home, they would have to build a brigade of people to pass buckets to the fire. So such societies were built for every need. New Orleans had hundreds of them, over 220 some societies. So sometimes it was dock workers organizing, trying to get better pay. Sometimes it was a fire engine service. Sometimes it was an athletic group. Sometimes it was a parading society. They called them societies, but they were organizations. In my hometown, they had one that met to deal with police brutality. And they would meet in a Black church if somebody got shot, which was often. So they didn't call themselves the police violence society, but that's what they were.
You know, you talked about David Walker. Tell us about his importance to the stories.
Well, David Walker was dead at the beginning of my book. He had been long dead. He's in the beginning of the book only as an example of the kind of militant Black thought that existed in the Atlantic world before the Civil War. He was from North Carolina, from the Atlantic coast, port town, went to Boston. He was a very militant member of a couple of groups. He was a Mason, and he thought Black people should rise up in the South. I put him there because we historians believe that there was a lot of political thought that was transmitted to people in slavery by way of sailors and people who were going in and out of ports. When Walker wrote his manifesto, it was delivered to ports all over the South, such that they even passed laws against reading or preaching what was called incendiary literature. That was a law in Virginia that stayed on the books till the 1960s. So he was an example of what Black political thought might look like if you could interview people in slavery at the time.
Now, I thought this was interesting, the arrival of Black teachers in different communities. And you gave the example about Charlotte 14. Can you tell us more about that?
There are quite a few people, usually from religious groups, who went down to teach Black people who had just become free. They did not pick women for a long time. They wouldn't let women go. They didn't pick Black people. So Charlotte Fortin was both female and Black, but it took her several tries to get a society that would send her to South Carolina or anywhere. Most of the women, the Black women who did it, one of the things that I think people don't quite understand about the activists who went south is they went from place to place to place. They saw what it was like in Norfolk, New Orleans, Jackson, Mississippi, rural Louisiana. Everybody I wrote about pretty much went to four or five places, and they spent a lot of time there. They organized people. They had rallies. They got people together to appoint a voting registrar, particularly this heated up, particularly before, just as it seemed apparent that Black men would get the vote in 1870. Starting in 1868, Black males could vote in some of the elections they had to do to make a new constitution so the states could be readmitted to the Union. So Charlotte Fortin was kind of more unusual in the sense that she was somewhat more privileged than the rest of the people who went. Some of the people who went had been slaves, escaped, went to the North, and they go back. They all had a profound experience seeing, they were all abolitionists, but when they get to the South and see what condition people had been left in by slavery, they all had transformative experiences seeing the actual condition of these millions of people. It was shocking to almost everyone, whether they were soldiers who came in the Union Army or ministers, or everybody was shocked at the huge size of the industry of slavery. So Charlotte Fortin was among them. She was kind of an amazingly talented person to go where she went, and it was a good meeting of circumstances in that she was a musician and a poet, had written theater works and stuff like that. So she wrote down in musical notation all the singing she heard from the usually Gullah people who were taking her back and forth to the mainland from the island she was on into Beaufort and places like that. So she was hearing all this singing and writing down, she was memorizing what they were singing and writing down the notes, playing them out on the piano. And she's the first person to document Black African-American music in the South and actually produce sheet music for it. She wrote down the words to the songs. She taught children and really at the Brick Church and what is now the Penn Center in South Carolina. But she didn't do well with the weather, so she occasionally had to get out of there because in the summer she got sickly, as people did, because they weren't used to the kind of vapors that were around in August. So she's served us a great done us a great favor by writing a diary while she was there. So that's how I know what I just told you. And I got really interested in her when I was in high school, but I'm just thrilled that she wrote everything down.
Black children and apprenticeship. You know, there were many stories about this and you brought this to life in your book. Can you give us examples of this? Because many people don't know about Black children being apprenticed.
I discuss it in the context of showing that Black women who had been enslaved sort of created a early protest movement, particularly in North Carolina, to gain custody of their children. It may seem logical that when people got out of slavery, they gained custody of their children. But the slave owners in a lot of places went to the state legislature, and then they would go to a local judge So somebody perhaps who had, let's say I had been enslaved, my local slave owner could go to a local judge, person he would know, and say he needed my children to work on his farm. He understands I'm free, but I'm not capable of being a good parent. So therefore, he should be the guardian of my children. Now, they might be my children by him. They might be my children by my husband of choice that I haven't yet legally been able to marry, whatever. Didn't matter. And they would be indentured to that slave owner till age 18. So one of the elements of farm life in the 19th century is all hands had to work. And so children growing up on farms did chores and helped the family to survive. If you were a single mother, and as in the case of one of the people I mentioned, and you have two teenage daughters, they are able hands and you could probably raise at least enough food to eat, but you would need their help. And In one case, the two daughters were kidnapped at night. They broke the sheriff's office, broke into her cabin, took the two daughters, put them in the local jail so they could wait for their former slave owner to come get them. And she had to get in a wagon the next day to even find out where they were. But if you can imagine the fear you would have as a former female enslaved person that your teenage daughters would be taken away from your protection back to a slave owner who might have abused you, you can imagine that Black women were very seriously mobilized by the idea of having their children taken away. And that's just one of the horrors of it. They also would have been worked very hard. So it's... it was something that became something of a movement throughout the South where women were trying to find ways to combat apprenticeships.
Now, the Black male leaders, sometimes they push for services for women and children. And you talk about this in your book, some of the services that they push for.
Well, some of them even tried to get women the vote several times, actually. There was some practicality involved in it and some concern having to do with being able to decide for the first time what the role of different people in a community could be, because they're rethinking community in different ways. So many women had to wanted to stay home and take care of their children, get out of the fields, for instance. Most people did field work, but field work, once they got out of slavery, got paid once a year in January when the crops were all in. So in freedom, they needed money every Friday or every Tuesday, or they needed money to buy food this week. So women went into the workforce, mostly as domestics, but until they could set up a shop as a seamstress or tailor or hairdresser or whatever, they went and did in service that they did in slavery if it would pay, you know, that week. So if they got paid once a week, it could keep the family going. So they did a lot of that kind of work. Black men understood in a lot of these cases where women suddenly went into the workforce, they understood from slavery that women worked as hard and in as expertly as men did. So men in Richmond, for instance, who were processing tobacco, packing it in barrels, basically to be shipped, they worked traditionally with enslaved women. The enslaved women were in a different room, but they were called stemmers. They're breaking the stems off the tobacco leaves and packing them neatly. The men sought higher wages. They were being paid less in freedom than they had been paid for the same exact work in slavery, except the pay went to their owners. So they already knew what the pay rates were. So instead of getting $15 a week, they would be paid 10, whatever. And they're having to pay rent in places like Richmond. So they fought for higher wages, including for women who were working in those tobacco places. And they appear to have been splitting their wages equally with women. So a lot of men in a lot of spheres of life in the South understood Black women to be not the fragile, gentle flower who was only going to be in the house with domestic concerns, protected and clothed and feted by a male head of household. There were many missionaries telling Black men that was exactly how they should treat women, but enslaved men, men in the South in general, knew that Black women were very competent workers.
Now, I thought this was interesting. You talked about Black males in terms of voting and how they were stopped from voting in many cases because of petty crime. Tell us about those stories.
Okay. I just want to say one more thing about women. They fought for women to vote too. And if you think about it, if Black women had been able to vote, they would have had double the vote, Black vote, and a majority electorate in a lot of places. So it was also smart. I'm sorry. So ask me your question again.
You looked at voter participation when Black males were voting and they could vote, but they were stopped from voting because maybe of a petty theft or something.
Oh, okay. We don't have time for me to explain the debate that had just taken place in making the 13th, 14th, and 14th and 15th amendments. But they had to figure out in Congress, like what your qualifications were for voting. Because they were going to let people who had been enslaved vote. Okay, so the one thing almost everybody agreed on was that people who had criminal charges against them, meaning heinous criminal charges, something serious, really serious, probably shouldn't be voting. Or people who were imprisoned weren't going to vote. I mean, these guys had just started really thinking about that because it had previously been white men who were educated and owned property. So they were sitting in Washington going, do we need to make people be educated to vote? Do they have to have property to vote? Knowing these new voters were not going to have large numbers of either. So in North Carolina in particular, I point out that they thought up the idea of charging Black men with serious crimes or any kind of crime. Now this goes on into becoming chain gangs and enforced labor later, but they start with the idea of just pulling, the equivalent of pulling a guy over for a traffic infraction. You didn't signal before changing lanes. Okay, so they stop them for a minor infraction, but they whip them. They put on their record that they had a punishment for a serious crime. So they give the guy the punishment and put down on his record that he had been found guilty of a more serious crime. And one of the state legislators in North Carolina stood up in the legislature and recommended that everybody in every county do this. And he says, we're not going to have one Black male voting in our county by the time the vote comes up in 1870. So it was an idea to disfranchise. It was a systematic effort to disfranchise. It was most famously done in Florida, and we're still living with the repercussions. But a lot of the voter repression tools that exist now were invented by these people in the age of emancipation and Reconstruction.
Now, what is the message you want the reader to leave with once they finish your book?
Well, I hope they have more than one message. I don't have one message. It's a long book. I'm hoping people understand that the beloved community that King talked about that he helped build was there much earlier. I hope people understand that one of the things enslaved African Americans have taught the rest of us is it takes a long time. Freedom takes a long time. It requires generations of work. People then and people when I was raised were told, one, you have to do your part, and two, it's not going to be over like that. It requires what we call long-term struggle. And I think they really built into this culture the idea, this is an idea that's also taken up by many other groups, of being able to sustain long-term struggle. Because building a real democracy cannot be done in one presidential administration or by one law or one Supreme Court edict. And we can tell just by what's going on now that the Supreme Court can set you back. We had about 80 years of the Supreme Court not honoring that Black people's vote was sacred and should be protected. They just didn't do it. So we would call that a setback. We are about to be really close to that place again, but we're still here. And we have the John Lewis Act. So if we can get that across to fix what happened before when we were set back, that is sort of, I hope my central message, keep at it, but I do want people to understand also that Black people who came out of slavery were not without tools. They built networks and links from village to village, to town, to whole regions. And if you look at the maps in my book, you'll see that Black people organized great swaths of every state they lived in. Some places they organized 4/5 of the state, some places 2/3, some places half. But those places they organized also became names that were famous in the 20th century, Selma, Birmingham, places that struggle was taken up again, Black Belt of Alabama in particular, Louisiana, New Orleans, Mississippi. Those are places where people have renewed struggle over the decades. So they're kind of deeply embedded in struggle, thanks to those people who emerge from slavery alive.
Well, I've taken up enough of your time. Can you tell us the next project you're going to be working on?
I'm writing a book about people like Louis Armstrong traveling up and down the Mississippi Valley and all the improvisers like him, men, women, dancers, singers, musicians, composers, gospel singers, everybody from Aretha Franklin's mother to William Grant Still, a classical music composer. They were itinerant musicians working in the same region at the same time. Many of them knew each other even, but I'm trying to show how once political activity in the South was crushed, that we started through innovation and improvisation to create four new different aspects of American culture in music and theater.
Well, we'll be looking forward to that one. We'll be looking forward to that one. And when your book comes out, please let us know. But right now, you can purchase The Emancipation Circuit, Black Activism, Forging a Culture of Freedom by Professor Talani Davis. And thank you so much for being on the podcast today.
Thank you.